Think about what it meant to cross the Atlantic Ocean in 1919. There were no satellites, no LORAN, no GPS, no weather radar, no radio navigation beyond the most primitive kind. If you wanted to know where you were over the North Atlantic at 3 in the morning, you looked out the window and tried to find a star. If the clouds were thick, you flew blind and hoped your compass was reading true. On May 16, 1919, three enormous flying boats lifted off from Trepassey Bay, Newfoundland, and pointed their noses east toward the Azores, 840 miles of open ocean, and most of the world expected at least one of them to die out there. I'm Tail Dragger, and this is The Hangar on Radio Hangar. Before we go any further into this story, a word from today's sponsor. Today's show is brought to you by AviationSoul.com, aviation challenge coins for every milestone in flight, first solo, private pilot, instrument rating, all the way up. If you've earned it, they've got a coin for it. Every coin tells a story. Check them out at AviationSoul.com. Now, where were we? The year is 1919, and the world wants to fly the Atlantic. The war had just ended. In 4 years, aviation had gone from a curiosity to a weapon, and the military pilots coming home knew what airplanes could do. The question wasn't whether someone would fly the Atlantic. The question was who would do it first, and whether they'd survive it. The British newspaper Lord Northcliffe had put up a prize of £10,000 for the first non-stop transatlantic flight. The money was real, the publicity was enormous, and pilots from several countries were already in Newfoundland building up to their attempts. It was a race, and the world was watching. But the United States Navy had a different idea entirely. They weren't chasing a prize, they were making an argument. The argument was that naval aviation was mature enough, powerful enough, capable enough to operate at oceanic distances. If you could fly the Atlantic, you could patrol the Atlantic, and they had spent the last 2 years of the war building the airplane to prove it. The Curtiss NC flying boat. NC standing for Navy Curtiss was something else. Her wingspan stretched 126 feet, four Liberty engines, each pushing out around 400 horsepower, mounted on struts above the lower wing. She could carry a crew of six. Fully loaded, she weighed more than 27,000 pounds. She was in 1919 one of the largest aircraft ever built. The Liberty engine itself deserves a moment. It was a water-cooled V-12, designed in a single frantic weekend in Washington in 1917 by a committee of automotive and aviation engineers who essentially locked themselves in a room and refused to leave until they had a design. The result was the standard American aviation power plant of the war, and when you had four of them running together at full power, the sound was something you felt more than heard. A deep thundering roar that rattled your teeth and pressed against your chest. The men who flew these aircraft flew with that sound in their ears for hours on end, over black water, in the dark, with nothing between them and the ocean but a wooden hull. Four of the NC boats were eventually ready. The NC-1, NC-2, NC-3, and NC-4. The NC-2 was cannibalized for spare parts before the mission even began. Her engines and components redistributed among her sisters to keep them flying. Three planes remained, three crews, three chances. Now here's where it gets interesting. The Navy solved the navigation problem, or tried to, with something that has never quite been replicated in the history of aviation. They positioned 57 destroyers and cruisers along the route from Newfoundland to the Azores, one ship every 50 miles, strung out across 800 miles of open Atlantic. Each vessel carried radio equipment, searchlights, flares, and orders to mark its position clearly for any aircraft that might be overhead. The idea was to create a corridor through the darkness, a highway of steel through the middle of the ocean. Think about the logistics of that for a moment. 57 warships repositioned across the North Atlantic. Thousands of sailors standing watch in the cold, pointing searchlights skyward, firing flares into the dark. The United States Navy reorganizing itself around the idea that three flying boats might need to find their way in the night. It was the most ambitious aviation support operation in history up to that point, and it still might be. The three planes that lifted out of Trepassey Bay that evening each had their own character and their own commanders. The NC-1 was led by Patrick Bellinger, with a pilot named Mark Mitcher at the controls. That name will mean something to most of you. Mark Mitcher would go on to command the fast carrier task forces in the Pacific during the Second World War. He'd be the admiral on the bridge of the USS Hornet when Jimmy Doolittle's bombers left the deck bound for Tokyo. He'd be the man who ordered all lights on when his pilots were coming home at night, with empty fuel tanks and no way to find the carrier in the dark. In 1919, he was a lieutenant with the best flying boat in the world under his hands, pointed into a black sky over the North Atlantic. The NC-3 was commanded by John Towers, the Navy's overall commander for the mission. Towers had designed the entire operation. He had the experience, the rank, and the weight of the mission on his shoulders. The NC-4 was commanded by Albert Reed, Commander Albert Callatin Reed, known to just about everyone as Putty. Quiet man, deliberate, methodical, not the kind of pilot who told stories at parties, the kind of pilot who checked his numbers twice and then checked them again. His crew of six included Lieutenant Elmer Stone of the Coast Guard as his primary pilot, one of the small details of this mission that tends to get lost, along with a second pilot, a navigator, a radio operator, and a mechanic. Six men in an open cockpit above a wooden hull with four engines growling above them and the Atlantic below. They departed Trepassey Bay on the evening of May 16th, the spray off Newfoundland catching the last of the light as those three great flying boats clawed their way into the air. Below them, the first destroyers in the corridor, searchlights swinging upward. The highway was open. What followed was the kind of night that makes pilots in armchairs go very quiet. The weather deteriorated. Clouds moved in from the north. The stars disappeared. The destroyers below were supposed to be visible. But fog settled on the ocean, and the lights simply vanished into the murk. Three separate aircraft, flying by compass and dead reckoning, each one alone in the dark with 800 miles of cold Atlantic between them and the Azores. The NC-1 got into trouble first. Bellinger and Mitcher flew into fog so thick they lost visual reference entirely. They came down through the overcast trying to find the surface, trying to get under the weather where they might see the destroyer lights. They found the ocean at wave height in zero visibility, and the NC-1 hit the water hard in the swells. The hull broke apart. The crew survived. They got off into life jackets and were rescued by a Greek freighter that happened to be nearby, but the airplane was gone. Mark Mitcher, the future Pacific Fleet Admiral, spent a night in the North Atlantic in a life jacket. The NC-3 found the corridor but then lost the formation in the overcast. Towers brought his aircraft down on the open ocean to assess the damage and attempt repairs. He couldn't get her back in the air. The swells were too heavy, the hull too stressed. The NC-3 was finished as a flyable aircraft, but John Towers refused to give up. For 52 hours, he and his crew rowed that broken flying boat across the open ocean. Engines running, water washing over the hull, taxiing. 200 miles on the surface of the Atlantic, under their own power, until they limped into the harbor at Ponta Delgada in the Azores. Battered, exhausted, and still in command of what remained of their aircraft. It is one of the most extraordinary acts of airmanship I have ever come across in 50 years of reading aviation history, and almost nobody talks about it. 2 days of taxiing a broken flying boat across the open Atlantic, pull up a chair for that one sometime, which left the NC-4. Putty Reed and his crew had flown through the same night, the same fog, the same black water below them, threading the corridor with the same uncertainty pressing down, and 15 hours and 18 minutes after lifting out of Trepassey Bay, the NC-4 settled onto the water at Horta in the Azores, her hull intact, her engine still running, her crew alive. They weren't done. The Azores to Lisbon was another 1,200 miles. Reed and his crew serviced the engines, waited for weather, and departed on May 27th. 9 hours and 19 minutes later, the NC-4 came down over the Portuguese coast and settled into the harbor at Lisbon. Ships fired their horns. People lined the waterfront. Telegraphs had been carrying the story across Europe, and the city came out to watch. They had crossed the Atlantic Ocean. For the first time in history, an aircraft had flown from the shores of North America to the shores of Europe. 4 days later, they pressed on to Plymouth, England, the full journey complete, 23 days from New York to England. Total flying time over the transatlantic route, approximately 54 hours. And then, 14 days after the NC-4 touched down in Plymouth, John Alcock and Arthur Witten Brown climbed into a converted Vickers Vimy bomber in St. John's, Newfoundland. 16 hours and 12 minutes later, they landed in a bog in County Galway, Ireland, first non-stop transatlantic flight, winner of the Northcliffe Prize, front page around the world. History, with its gift for clean stories, handed the headline to Alcock and Brown, and it wasn't entirely wrong to do so. Their crossing was nonstop. One aircraft, no fleet of destroyers. It was a different and in some ways purer achievement. The stories are not in competition, but something got lost in the shuffle. Putty Reed crossed the Atlantic first. His crew flew an aircraft where no aircraft had ever flown. They did it with four Liberty engines above them, a wooden hull below them, compasses they had to trust, absolutely, and stars they often couldn't see. They proved the thing was possible before anyone else proved anything. That's not a footnote. That's the opening sentence. The NC-4 still exists. She's at the National Naval Aviation Museum in Pensacola, Florida. If you haven't been to that museum, add it to your list right now. The collection at Pensacola is one of the finest in the country. They have aircraft going back to the earliest days of naval aviation, through the jets of the Cold War, and everything in between. But the NC-4 is something apart. They've built a space for her that does justice to that 126-foot wingspan. The hull sits low, the way a boat hull should, and above it the wings go out further than your eye expects. Four nacelles on their struts, the Liberty engines long gone, but the structure otherwise remarkably intact after more than a century. The restoration work the museum has done on her is careful and honest. They've preserved the original materials where they can. They've documented what's original and what's been replaced, and the displays around the aircraft tell the story properly. The charts showing the route, the photographs of the crew, the communications logs from the destroyers. They've done right by this airplane. Standing under those wings and looking up, you start to feel the weight of what Reed's crew actually did. Six men in leather and wool, in an open cockpit, engines roaring above them, flying through North Atlantic fog in the dark. No weather service that could tell them what was ahead. No terrain avoidance because the ocean is flat and indifferent. Just the compass, the clock, the dead reckoning, and the faith that the math would come out right. Albert Putty Reed came home to a ticker tape parade in New York and a meeting with President Wilson at the White House. He received the Navy's Distinguished Service Medal. He went back to the Navy, served a long career, and retired as a Rear Admiral. He's buried at Arlington National Cemetery. The NC-4 is in Pensacola, and in the space between those two facts lives a story that deserves more sunlight than it usually gets. Most of what I've covered today draws from the National Naval Aviation Museum's own records and the historical work of aviation historians who have reconstructed the mission from the original logs and communications. Richard Gillespie's research on early transatlantic aviation is worth tracking down if you want the full picture. You can find us at radiohangar.com. Go look up Putty Reed sometime. He earned it.